Welcome to Out of the Question, a podcast that looks behind some common questions and uncovers the question behind the question while providing real solutions for biblical world and life view. Your co-hosts are Andrea Schwartz, a teacher and mentor, and Pastor Charles Roberts.
Thanks for joining us today. The language and terminology we use should reflect a biblical world and life view. But very often, we all fall prey to using the humanistic terms of our culture. It's easy to do since we are bombarded with politically correct terms that have become as ubiquitous as foul and obscene language. Here are a few that in no way have root in biblical foundation. The term biological women, rather than women. As soon as we assign this adjective, we are opening the door to another kind of woman. Another, the designation of hate crimes, as though someone is less dead if there wasn't assumed to be a racial motivation. The Bible talks in terms of killing that doesn't fall into the categories laid out in the law of God. Thus, murder is murder. The subject Charles and I will be discussing today is the concept of women's spaces and men's spaces due to the increasing prevalence of mentally ill men and women deciding that they are women and men, and for those who are men in this state of delusion competing in women's sports. This, along with the use of locker rooms, bathrooms, and places women go for relief and refuge after abusive circumstances, have sparked the debate of gender-specific spaces. Now, Charles, when you and I were growing up, there was no such talk of the circumstances or the terminology I just referred to. If you had to pinpoint when did things that all people, even children, understood become the subject of corrupted language?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think, like so many other of the ills in our society, it really began to snowball or develop in the 60s and into the 70s. But even then, I mean, you had people who would have been aghast at some of the things you just described. But, you know, the seeds were there, especially as it relates to other issues concerning human sexuality. Especially relates to the homosexual issues. Many people today, you know, biblical Christians are concerned about that issue. But, you know, I believe it was one of the sitcoms of the 1970s, maybe, or early 80s, definitely, I think it might have been the 70s, where there was the first openly homosexual character in the sitcom. And that was a while ago. It wasn't just last year. So I think the corruption of language and the effort to change people's consciousness goes back at least 50 years or more. However, let me just say this, and this is, I believe, is an indirect, but a direct indirect connection to what we're talking about. I wonder how many of our listeners are familiar with a type of people who they're in a similar category as these men who want to be women and vice versa, but they call themselves furries. Are you familiar with that term?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So, you know, these are people who dress up like cats or dogs and have someone lead them around on a leash. You see them, you can find videos of this, of people in, you know, Midtown Manhattan being led around like this in the most outlandish. And these people apparently take this very seriously. They pretend like they think. What struck me is I've been preaching through the book of Daniel. And this is exactly what the Lord did to Nebuchadnezzar to drive him crazy or to make him crazy. I mean, thinking that way, and I think we can also include in this the main issue we're talking about, it is a sign of God's condemnation and covenantal judgment on a person or people when they begin to think that they're the wrong sex or the opposite sex of what they really are biologically, quote unquote, or think they're actually an animal when they're human.
Right. So if you peruse, and I did just in preparation for this, YouTube videos on the whole concept of women's spaces. They are a great example of relativism gone wild. See, it just matters if we call it a war against women and that men are invading women's spaces under a pretense. And there is no shortage of people who will weigh in on this. Feminists weigh in on this. Lesbians weigh in on this. Transgender people weigh in on this. Everybody has an opinion. And the prevailing theme for those who find this practice or the state of affairs heinous is that women are entitled to privacy in bathrooms, in locker rooms, and women are entitled to be able to compete fairly in athletics. And the question that I asked myself, and you can weigh in on this, is how do we know these things are true? Why should a woman or females have one bathroom and males have another? Certainly, we don't have that in our homes. I mean, I don't think, unless you have an enormous number of people and a lot of wealth, that only men can use this bathroom and only women can use this bathroom, although you might decide for convenience. But where did we get the idea that everybody knows that this is wrong? So the question is, where does everybody know this if they're not finding their absolutes in the Word of God? So why do we all know that women shouldn't have to change in front of men in locker rooms?
Well, I think that there's a certain amount of inherited or inherent understanding about the nature of sexuality, at least in most cultures, if not all of them, that what you're describing is the case. Just as even without an elaborate legal code, in most cultures, murder is forbidden, the killing of one human being unjustly by another. And this is true in many societies and cultures where nobody's ever heard of God's law. But we know that when God created the earth, that he established certain rules and regulations for Adam and Eve long before the law was given through Moses. So there was a creation ordinance, a law inherent in creation. And I think obviously the problems that arose concerning male and female relations sexually go all the way back to that very beginning. So yes, in the context of a covenanted marriage relationship, you know, men and women, husbands and wives more specifically, can and sometimes do share bathrooms. But that's the key factor there is their connection in a prior engagement and commitment in a covenant relationship.
Right. So instead of calling it a war on women, I think a better way to designate this is a war on God's law, a war on God's standard. But it didn't just start with certain men putting on dresses or bathing suits and taking away medals from women. The funny thing, Charles, about statist solutions is they don't solve any problem. They just make it worse. Right. So think back, and I remember finding this very, very odd, but it didn't appear that other people did. Go back to the time when you started seeing women sports commentators. And by their own admission, when they were allowed into the men's locker room, some of the men were dressed, some of the men were in towels, and some were walking around stark naked. But you see, women had this now privilege of being in the midst of this because they had attained to be sports commentators. Or, and this is an interesting tidbit that people may not know, the woman who's currently launching the idea that in Congress, men who think they're women shouldn't have access to women's spaces and bathrooms is a woman who fought her way into the military academy, the Citadel, because you see, these were only men's spaces and now women should be there as well. So you kind of see this coming full circle when things like Title IX were instituted so that women could have an equal chance. It didn't matter that people didn't want to come and watch women do sports. What mattered was we had to be equal. And what a lot of people don't know, that a lot of universities had to give up their football program because they had to have the same number of women in sports as men. So as soon as you want a privilege for yourself at the expense of others, I don't know that people should be surprised that somebody didn't figure out, well, it worked for them, it can work for us.
Yeah, and I don't. I think there's an interesting connection here. You asked me about, when did we start crossing these boundaries, and when did this all start to come about? And that's a multifaceted question, and I think the answer is equally so. But it occurred to me when you first asked me to bring up this particular fact, and I want to be very clear in stating this, that when I bring up this subject, it's not because I have a beef about the issue. Here's what I mean. When I was growing up here in South Carolina, and this was broadly true across the southern United States in the 1950s and 60s, African American people could not use the same bathrooms that white people used. When I was just going into junior high school, I had a job at a local place in the city where I grew up, owned by a family who were members of the church where I grew up in. And I distinctly remember there were three bathrooms: men, women, and colored. When the state fair came to my hometown, it was in town for 2 weeks. The first week was for white people, the second week was for black folks. So the thing is, we can certainly discuss, and I don't mean here, but it certainly were up for discussion about the legality of such prohibitions. But the problem is, those discussions and the prohibitions themselves and the aftermath were all done outside the boundaries of God's law and what God's law requires. They were done from a humanistic standpoint, maybe to begin with, and then the solutions were proposed in the same way. So my point is, when you go down the path of changing who is allowed in what space without a biblical frame of reference, it leads to an unraveling in other areas that maybe people didn't think about or anticipate. Now, the curious thing is, with the so-called transgender issues, I have, across the span of my life, been encountered and known of and known people from different walks of life, including several who were homosexuals. And some of the, there's an entire genre and subculture among those people. I don't know today, but going back and when it was not as out in the open as it is now, in the 40s and especially the 50s and early 60s, there were different groups of these people, and you still see it, who were committed to sadomasochism and leather. Then there was usually, from what I was understood, for people who were going down this unfortunate path, there was a general phase that many of them went through where they liked to dress up like women. But I don't recall ever hearing about any homosexual who wanted to be in the bathroom or the locker room of the opposite sex. They'd much rather be in one of their own sex, because that's the attraction. So it's hard for me to characterize exactly what the motivation of these people are, unless they themselves are just absolutely out of their minds and don't really know what they're trying to accomplish. Or the worst case scenario, and maybe this is the realistic thing, is these guys who claim to be, think that they're women really understand they're not, and they're just wanting to get into a woman's locker room. And I would say also, just finally, it's hard for me to also imagine what would be the interest of any man to be in a woman's bathroom for any reason, and vice versa. So I'll leave it at that.
It dawned on me as I was thinking about women's spaces, men's spaces, that it's a very individualistic thing. We're making women a category, and all women are going to think the same way on every subject. And then there's the men's category. And scripture does talk about older women discipling younger women, because for sure, women have issues that men do not have. And it's going to benefit younger women to learn from the experience of older women. And in the same way, when we talk about Titus 2 women, but the book of Titus also talks in terms of men discipling men. But when you remove it from a family context, and now we're going to have some bureaucrat make a decision, like for example, in my hometown, San Jose, there was big news over the fact that San Jose State University has a man on its women's volleyball team. And even people within the program, including an assistant coach, said this is wrong. She was fired. And then I think the captain of the team, who I don't think is any longer the captain of the team, filed suit. So it actually went to a judge to determine if this guy could play on the team for the championship that took place last weekend. Well, we have a judge making this adjudication. And by the way, the judge said, yes, he can be on the women's team. And other teams in even the conference championship forfeited, saying we won't play. But San Jose State got to the finals, lost in the finals. And so somehow or other, I think that tells everybody you shouldn't have complained because they didn't really have that much of an advantage, as if the final score was what this issue was about. But when you take it outside the realm of family law, church law, and you make the civil government the adjudication of what's moral and what's not, you've got a society that is clearly on its death throes. Because you can ask a five-year-old what's a boy and what's a girl, and the five-year-old knows, but it takes education and propaganda for that five-year-old then to become someone who says, well, that was just assigned at birth, as if that means something. So I guess my point in all this is we've got to stop using the terminology. I'm a woman, you're a man. I'm not a biological woman and you're a biological man. We are the definition based on God created the male and female. And as soon as we get into all this other stuff, we're actually legitimizing this reprobation.
Yeah, and I think another factor that can be added to the discussion about analyzing how this progressed, how we got to this point, it can be traced back to the influence of atheistic and anti-Christian philosophies in the early to mid-20th century. I'm thinking specifically of existentialism. And we've talked about this before, but I think it plays heavily into this. I mean, one of the men who is considered something of the godfather of the modern unimaginable nonsense of human sexuality was Michel Foucault, the French existential writer, who himself was a sodomite, a homosexual. But he had a tremendous influence in the late 20th century on issues of sexuality that I may be a little off base. Maybe some of your readers or listeners or listeners can correct me if I am. But I think he had a tremendous influence on what would become the so-called transgender movement. But he built on the foundation of the writings of people like Jean-Paul Sartre, who argued that, you know, there is no God. There's no God, and there can never be and never was a God. So human beings must start with the simple, bland, bald, horrible fact that we exist with no meaning whatsoever, except what we choose to give it. And so I am the master of my fate, and I'm admittedly glossing over a lot of technical, philosophical stuff that he and other philosophers would have written about, but I'm the master of my fate. I can create myself, and I can be whatever I choose to be. Now, I don't even think a guy like Jean-Paul Sartre would have ever imagined that his teachings and his writings could have been, you know, molded and fashioned into what we see nowadays. And that just shows the inconsistency of a lot of people who articulate things that over decades and maybe even centuries turn into something unimaginable. And I think that is another factor where we have people who don't seem to understand the simplest and basic things of God's created order. Yes, children understand very quickly that there's something different between them and their parents, them, their brother or sister. And the context of family law, of covenant family law, is the parents teach the children. They don't have to teach their children that they're males, contrary to what the modern crazy people say. What they teach them is how you interact with that opposite sex in a way that honors the Lord. And any society that starts down the path that we are currently on ends in suicide. It ends in absolute total disaster, because you can only deal with the created order that a sovereign God has given us. And if you don't follow his law order, sooner or later, it will implode on you. Now, you know, you and I, before the discussion started, we were talking about something relating to ancient Rome. And it's interesting to see in the progress of Roman society, where Roman culture was based on a strong emphasis on family life. Now, it wasn't biblical emphasis, but it was there nonetheless. And the corruption that would eventually enter into Roman society started on that level, and then eventually reached the highest echelons, to where you had, you know, senators and emperors in ancient Rome who were just as corrupt and sexually crazy as people are today. I don't know who would be considered the worst, but it begins with a corruption of family life, even a pagan family life, where there were certain values that were respected in a general sense. But especially if we are intending to follow what God's law word tells us, if we don't follow that, as I said a moment ago, it's a path to suicide.
And it boils down to the voice of authority. Where does the authoritative commands, mandates, practices come from? If they don't come from God, then they will be assigned, talking about assigning things, to someone else. And your point about teaching taking place in the family, I would dare say, Charles, that even within Christian families, sometimes we have people confused as to how they are to raise sons and daughters. I've heard many of a Christian man who only has daughters talking about, I let my girls know they can be anything they want to be, that they don't have to defer to anyone else just because they're women. Well, I'm sorry, Dad, but the Bible prescribes certain roles. And the only reason that a father would say that, other than I'm preparing my daughter to be a wife and a mother, understanding it's the bedrock foundation of society, is that that person has been influenced, corrupted by this idea that, well, if I had sons, I wouldn't care, but I have daughters, and so this is what I'm going to do. It's that we have lost the sense that God looked on his creation and said it was good, which meant the role, the physiology, the emotional aspects of being female were to complement the physical, emotional, and masculine components of what it means to be a man, and that together that they were supposed to serve God. So it really doesn't matter, should a woman be a Supreme Court justice, or should a woman be allowed to be a doctor? Or some people would say, oh, she should only be a nurse, she shouldn't be a doctor. That's not the point. That's talking about incidentals. Is this woman, is this man actually being trained and live and being required to be obedient to the mandates of Scripture because God is the voice of authority, not the modern, TV commentator or journalist or celebrity?
You can see evidence of a lot of what you're talking about in our modern culture with especially motion pictures. I haven't been to a movie theater and I couldn't tell you when, but I see the commercials on television, and it's striking to me that well, there are a number of things that are striking to me, but in terms of our discussion, it's interesting that the action films, almost all of the major characters are female. You know, they're no longer heroes, they are heroines. They don't even use that term, but in other words, the men aren't the ones who fight off the giants and the dragons and the evil. It's women. The women are almost always cast in the positive role as the great hero type. And I think that's another example of where this biblical distinction between what God has ordained for men and women, including their spaces, is being obliterated, much to the detriment of but people will eventually find out it, and it's going to be too late for some people in some cultures that we've been sold a bill of goods. And Satan's project from the very beginning was to destroy human beings as the image bearers of God. And I think it was Francis Schaeffer who said many, many, many decades ago that you have certain ideas that begin in philosophy, they eventually work their way through the culture and then wind up impacting theology. So we're also seeing this in organized churches as well. There have been some churches and some denominations that have, pretended to have female leadership, and the Protestant, conservative, reformed, and evangelical type churches generally never caved into that, some of that. But now, of course, that's no longer the case. So, we see this influence in all segments of society because society has largely rejected the authority of God's word. And so these things begin to play out, and things, if you were alive at a time when at least a tip of the hat was given to it, even if it was maybe not all that solid, you begin to see how totally insane the society has become. But with fewer and fewer people who remember a time when that was not the case, it doesn't seem, all that out of the ordinary. But one last thing, in that the conduit for much of what we're talking about among so-called Christian families, of course, as you said, is the government, but especially its government school system. How many parents have been very, very glad who have their children in so-called public schools that they have sex education programs? Oh, thank goodness. I would be so uncomfortable talking to little Johnny or Sally about sexuality. I'm glad, the school's going to take care of that for me.
Yeah. Even the idea that caring parents, parents who will go to a school board meeting and say, I don't want boys in the girls' bathroom and such, and having to petition this group of 10, 12, 15 people to please change your policy, it makes me say, like, why are they even there? You know, that's like going to a restaurant and said, we, you know, a lot of people are dying because of the poison in your food. Could you just use less of it? Or could we just have you stop using poison and then let's vote on it, sort of thing? It's like how people lost their minds that you negotiate with such, in my perspective, terrorist thinking that we're going to force you to do these things. But even the humanists in media who have come out against transgender women in women's bathroom, which means a man in a woman's bathroom, they say that they do it because they have daughters and they're concerned about their daughters. It's like, that's the reason you're against this, because you have daughters. I see. Then we're back to relativism. If you had sons, you'd say, oh, this is somebody else's problem. And so if we're not going to start off with God's premises, how on earth can we expect God to bless our efforts? Even in where we are right now, it's an uphill battle for us to reestablish biblical norms. But if you're not willing to engage in that battle, then, as the scripture says, you're not found faithful.
And it really is a battle on a lot of different levels. I mean, in terms of our personal walk with the Lord and our personal commitment to sanctification and holiness, we fight it on that level. But then on the family level, it's the same. And among any of our listeners who have ever been involved in homeschooling, you think you've got something of a safe haven from the evils of the government school system, and you do to some extent. But I know it was my experience and my wife and I's experience with our children. We looked for a lot of different programs apart from a homeschool co-op. But with the introduction of the internet and web classes and things like that, you had an inroad into homeschooling from programs and organizations that maybe they weren't as overtly anti-Christian and anti-biblical as the government school system, and they were doing it through online classes, video classes, but there really wasn't that firm commitment to homeschooling as the command of the Lord to Christian families. And so that too could become a conduit for pernicious things and bad ideas.
I experienced the same thing. You run a tight ship in our family, one television, and you had to ask permission for it to go on. Then with the advent of the phone, it was like, good, then if the kids need me, they can call me. I can see where they are. But you really invited in a multitude of other influences. And I remember when it dawned on me, Charles, when we were in a public gathering and somebody was talking about a television show, which I hadn't seen. I didn't know what they were referring to. But one of my children said, oh, yeah, remember the episode? And I'm thinking, wait a minute, how does my child know about this episode? Well, lo and behold, you could watch these things on your phone. And so the solution isn't, well, let's bar phones from everybody. And I know that people do that. And then as soon as their children turn of legal age, it's like, now I'm going to do what I want. But what would it be like if, in actual fact, we understood these influences are all around us anyway, and that our children would come to us and say, by the way, I saw this. Can we talk about it? I think the reason that that doesn't often happen is we've lost the idea as the family, as the main cohesive unit. And then we have our peers, my friends, and they become the dominant influence. And so until such time as the people of God get serious, warn your 5-year-old, warn your 7-year-old, warn your 11-year-old that the wages of sin is death. And it's not like if you fool me, you have somehow or other fooled God, because you never will. And I think that's more of how we have to teach our children.
Yes, and I think that one of the sources of the problems, at least among, you know, Christians who aspire to be faithful in this area, has been the corruption or the outright ignoring of this issue of the foundation of the family. You know, ancient Israelite society was family-centered. And, you know, God's law speaks to issues relating to families, to husbands and wives, and to the larger communities around the covenant nation of Israel and composed of individual covenant families. But as over time, that became corrupted, even in the time of Jesus, you know, he was having problems with the so-called leaders of the Jews, the Pharisees, who were had adopted a largely pagan-influenced view of God's law. And so when he would talk about things relating to God's law, they would go out of their minds and, you know, accuse him of teaching false things. And we have a similar thing going on today. And it was actually Dr. Rushdoony, among others, but especially him, who called our attention to this very foundational fact that the family is the foundation, the first school, the first church, the first, quote, government that a child is introduced to. And unless there is an effort to maintain a biblical standard in that family in all areas, then something else is going to come in and take its place. I think that people need to realize this, and I said a moment ago, this is a serious, serious battle. And unless we're willing to put our shoulders to the wheel and fight that battle in a very overt way, then those who don't like that, who don't like the fact that the foundation of any culture or society is the family, and the only truly successful and prosperous ones are those that are found on biblical principles, those are going to be constantly under attack, and there's going to be the constant effort to displace God's law word and the position of God in the family with something offered by the state, by a humanistic worldview.
And the state will often pander to what somebody has a gripe about. And so if you don't know history, for example, you won't know the influence of the Enlightenment on our culture and how the Enlightenment was very, very instrumental in putting women on a pedestal. Well, people will say, isn't that wonderful? No, because if you put something on a pedestal, then it's separate and you don't expect much from it. Quite the contrary of honoring women, it was sort of how to displace them and let them think they're being honored when they're not. So that was never biblical. And this whole idea of what it means to be a biblical wife and mother has been lost because we have taken the attitudes from other eras and said, oh, that was Christianity. Mm-hmm. Rushdoony was very, very definite that feminists had legitimate gripes. They were denied certain things, and there were things that weren't just in terms of biblical justice. But he pointed out that the problem was that instead of using biblical solutions, getting people back on God's path, they decided to use the tactics of those who they considered were oppressing them. And so they did to them what they felt had been done to them. And really, the feminist movement at its worst was all about using the tactics of the oppressor to then go ahead and oppress who you considered was your oppressor. Well, isn't it interesting now that the same arguments that they used are now being used in terms of transgender rights? Like, how would you feel if this is how you were being treated? The same thing was true about homosexuality in general, was how would you feel if you loved someone who happened to be of the same sex? Well, does it matter how we feel? Does the Bible in any place say, stop, hard stop? How does this person feel about the fact that he really wants to rape someone? You know, how do we feel about it? God's laws are objective laws. So the fact that you want to do something and you can't do it, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time wondering how you feel. The question is obedience. Holiness is obedience. Obedience is holiness because we're establishing God as the rule and the standard. So when we make it these emotional pleas, now you have people who got their due. They got into quote unquote men's spaces and they were cheering themselves. And you had people who were accepted because of their sexual preference, now finding themselves on the short end of the stick, but they don't have any real way to say it's wrong other than, I don't like it. It's triggering me. You're making me feel bad, as if that becomes a standard that anybody should pay a whole lot of attention to.
Yeah, I can recall on more than a few occasions over the decades hearing otherwise well-meaning people reacting to, and I'll go back to a time that you and I are familiar with and maybe some of our listeners, in the era of the 1960s when the culture began its first efforts at imploding, you know, the reaction of some of the older generation to what was going on in the 60s and early 70s, whether it be the music or the apparel or whatever it may be, is that, well, I just don't feel like that's a good thing. You know, there's no reference other than, like you just said, to their feelings. Now, maybe there's something there that they understand. There's something not quite right about X, Y, and Z. But, you know, unless you can articulate clearly to someone why this is wrong, other than, I just don't feel like it's the right thing, you're not going to get anywhere. And, you know, let me just say, too, that getting back to the issue of the centrality of the family and its law order, one of the things that I think has also led to this, and unfortunately, it began to show up very early in the Christian movement, was the lack of emphasis among the earliest Christians on the centrality of the family that had been a part of the older covenant, ancient Israelite emphasis, as having been under the authority of God's law word. Not that it was perfect, but it was there. So when the Jews rejected Christ and Paul turns to the Gentiles, and you have this influx of pagans who have come to faith in Christ, but without that framework of God's law, something very different begins to take its place. And so rather than a strong emphasis on Christianity and biblical law as a way of living and a way of life, through the influence of Greek philosophy, it becomes a way of a type of philosophy, just another way of arguing and thinking and discussion. And so over time, it begins to be, well, we can vanquish the pagans through our debates, and we have better arguments than they do, you know, rather than our families are more stable and more clearly biblical because we follow from the ground up how our children are to behave, how the husband and wife behave towards each other. So something was lost in that transition. And I think that's something, too, that Dr. Rastuni, and building on the work of others, you know, he called this to our attention, that this is a vitally important thing, and we need to recover this if we're going to be successful in this battle against humanism.
And let me go one step further. I think Paul actually addressed this when he tells his listeners that if you're a believer and you are married to an unbeliever, stay married. Mm-hmm. In other words, Christianity wasn't about destroying the family unit. He said, you're a believer, then let's say you're a woman, then your husband is sanctified through you, your children are sanctified through you. And the only caveat he says is if your spouse is adamantly opposed and says, I'm out of here, that you don't have to say, no, 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 don't leave. In other words, that the structure of the family was not being disintegrated because now there was the Christian family. And in writing about the whole idea in 1 Corinthians about head coverings, I think that we could say that it was a visible symbol to all that women weren't going to be running renegade and not having to be under authority, because the whole idea of covering your head and a man not covering his head had to do with the so-called chain of command. Now, some will argue that was cultural. I don't argue it that it was cultural, because it happens to exist in the exact same chapter of the words of institution of communion. So if Paul was being, okay, let's put this in parentheses and say it's just cultural, but let's keep saying this now for 2,000 years. The point being, is that the family wasn't being usurped by the church. It was recognized continuous as the basic unit of society. And I agree that that's lost. And you see it played out, you know, that you have some, when people walk into churches, this age group goes here, this age group goes there. When it's time to preach from the word, the children are excused. Why? Why would you excuse them? Well, they might not understand. Well, then make it understandable. You know, it's right. Like as soon as we give into these things and we see good reasons, I've used this example in the past. I remember when my son, I think he was like 4 years old, we were at a church and he said, I want to take communion. Everybody else is taking communion. The rules of the church were that he would have to be baptized first. And so did he understand what he was capable of understanding? Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And so he was baptized and he felt now part of the covenant family. And we continue to remind him that he was. But when we do this practice of waiting until someone decides he wants to, then we've lost this idea that, wow, you can have a family and some are covenant members and others aren't. It destroys the family. I don't know what you think about this, but I'm very strong on this perspective.
Well, I just want to say that I think anything biblically that can strengthen the understanding of the centrality of the family that God has put into his created order is something that needs to be promoted and understood. And as we wrap up this discussion, I think that our listeners hopefully have gained an understanding that when we talk about some of the crazy issues in our culture today about, I have to divest myself of this goofy term, men wanting to use women's restrooms and pretending that they are women, that there's a lot more at stake here than just personal preference or personal disgust. There's a reason, as you alluded, that people feel that way. And I think in terms of something that I would recommend, maybe start with the calcedon.edu website under the resources tab and just search for that under the term family or sexuality. Dr. Rushdoony, throughout many of his writings, including the Institutes of Biblical Law, let's say Salvation and Godly Rule, there are a number of these where he has talked about these issues, and the website is a good place to start. I don't know, maybe you know that he has written anything extensively, like an entire book on the subject of the Christian family. Maybe you can clarify that for me.
Certainly, there's the book Toward a Christian Marriage.
Oh, yes.
That's right. He had an essay and a number of other people contributed to it.
Right.
But let me just say this. So, yes, once you understand the family and once you get a sense of what God was accomplishing in the creation of Adam and Eve and being told to be fruitful and multiply, that the Bible is a family book. We wouldn't have the part that lots of people skip over in the genealogies. Notice they didn't say, and this president took, you know, and this, you know, it was not a statist genealogy. It was a family genealogy. And right. So we've gotten away from that. And I don't think most people even realize that God was making a point over and over and over again about the family. But let me just say one thing that I meant to cover and we didn't. There is a tremendous inconsistency between the idea or those who say, well, just like we don't want to discriminate based on skin color, we shouldn't discriminate based on gender. Well, that's a totally inconsistent argument, because the argument on skin color is somebody did not have any choice in terms of the color of his or her skin. Much the same way that no one had a choice as to whether or not they were going to be a male or a female. That was something determined by God before. So in the same way, if you said we're not to judge people by the color of their skin, that all people should be viewed this way, then why do we want to change the fact of the objective nature of whether someone was born male or female? And so don't feel like, and I'm saying this to people because I know that it's a struggle when you're in a group of people who want to argue this point and make you look like a bigot, that first of all, bias and prejudice are not always bad. Prejudice means I've prejudged something. Well, if you're prejudging something on the law of God, well done, good and faithful servant. But if you're judging something based on unrighteousness, well, that's not a good thing. And I think the more we hold to what we believe and not use the world's terms, I think, Charles, it doesn't mean the battle won't get hot and heavy, but at least we'll be on the right side of what it means to be faithful.
Yes, and I hope that our discussion will prove helpful to our listeners who may be dealing with these things on a very serious basis. And these issues tend to rise and fall in terms of intensity or popularity, depending on, you know, what's going on or where people live. So whether when this goes live next week, I guess, or whenever, this may be or may not be a pressing issue for some of our folks, but for others who somewhere down the line, it could be proved very, very helpful. So I'm very glad that we were able to talk about this.
Right. And it's a personal issue for in families, but it's also a societal issue. Because when we say that God's law doesn't count, God's word doesn't count, we then as a society are basically thumbing our nose at God and saying, so what are you going to do about it? And I don't think that's ever a good position to be in.
No.
Out of the question podcast at gmail.com is how you reach us. And once again, thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to Out of the Question. For more information on this and other topics, please visit calcedon.edu.